"The sailors have left the wreck," Garion said. "And the tide has gone out enough that all but the very aft end of the ship is now out of the water. I can take the pack horses and go back down there to see what I can find." Durnick's fire had begun to crackle. He stood up and looked at Eriond. "Can you manage here?" he asked. Eriond nodded and went behind the buttress for more wood. The smith bent and picked up his cloak. "Thoth and I'll go with you, Garion, just in case those sailors decide to come back. But we're going to have to hurry. It's going to start getting dark before too long." The gale still howled across the weather-rounded top of the headland, driving rain and sleet in front of it. Garion and his two friends picked their way carefully down the slope again toward the forlorn-looking ship, lying twisted and broken on the boulder that had claimed its life. "How long do you think this storm is going to last?" Garion shouted to Durnick.
"It's hard to say," Durnick shouted back. "It could blow over tonight, or it could keep it up for several days."
"I was afraid you'd say that." They reached the wreck, dismounted and entered the hold through the opening they had previously made in the bow.
"I don't think we'll find too much down here," Durnick said. "Our own food's all spoiled. I don't think the sailors stored anything perishable in the hold."
Garion nodded. "Can we get Aunt Paul's cooking things? She'll want those, I think."
Durnick peered aft at the bilge-soaked bags and bales lying in a tumbled heap in the shattered stern. The surf was sloshing over them through the holes rent in the hull at that end of the ship.
"I think so. I'll go take a look."
"And as long as we're here, we might as well pick up the rest of the things we had in the aft cabins," Garion said. "I'll go gather them up while you and Thoth see what the sailors left behind at the galley."
He climbed carefully over the splintered timbers at the point where the keel had broken. Then he went up the ladder to the hatch above. He slipped and slid down the deck to the aft companionway. It took him perhaps a quarter of an hour to gather up the belongings they had left behind when they had fled the wreck. He wrapped them all in a sheet of sailcloth and went back up onto deck. He carried his bundle forward and dropped it over the side onto the wet sand of the beach. Durnick poked his head out of the forward companionway.
"Well, there isn't much, Garion. The sailors picked it over pretty thoroughly."
"Well, we'll have to make do with whatever we can find, I guess."
Garion squinted up through the rain. The sky was growing noticeably darker.
"And we'd better hurry."
They reached the top of the headland in a gale-torn twilight and carefully led their horses along the edge of the bluff to the entrance of the cellar as the last tatters of daylight faded out of the sky. The inside of the vaulted chamber was warm now, filled with the light of the fire dancing on the hearth. The others had strung lines from the arches during their absence, and their blankets and clothing hung dripping and steaming along the walls.
"Any luck?" Silk asked as Garion led his horse inside. "Well, not much. The sailors cleaned out the galley pretty thoroughly."
Durnick and Thoth led in the other horses and lifted down a number of makeshift packs.
"Oh, we found a bag of beans, though," the smith reported, "and a crock full of honey. There was a sack of meal back in a corner, and a couple of sides of bacon. The sailors left the bacon behind. It seemed moldy. But we ought to be able to cut most of that mold away."
"That's all?" Polkara asked.
"Well, I'm afraid so, Paul," Durnick replied. "We picked up a brazier and a couple of bags of charcoal, since there doesn't seem to be any firewood in this part of the world."
She frowned slightly, running over the inventory he had just given to her.
"Well, it's not very much, Paul, but it was the best we could do."
"I can manage with it, dear," she said, smiling at him.
"I picked up the clothes that we left in those aft cabins, too," Garion said as he unsaddled his horse. "A few of them are even dry."
"Good," Polgara said. "Let's all change into whatever dry clothing will fit. I'll see what I can do about something to eat."
Silk had been looking suspiciously at the sack of meal.
"Gruel?" he asked, looking unhappy. "Beans would take much too long to cook," she replied. "Porridge and honey, and a bit of bacon. That will get us through the night."
Silk sighed. The following morning, the rain and the sleet had let up, although the wind still tore at the long grass atop the headland. Geryon wrapped in his cloak stood on the ledge outside the entrance to the cellar, looking out over the froth-tipped waves in the gulf and the surf pounding on the beach far below. Off to the southeast, the clouds seemed to be growing thinner, and patches of blue raced along through the dirty-looking murk covering the rest of the sky. Sometime during the night, the tide had once again washed over the wreck of the ship, and the aft end had broken away and been carried off. A number of huddled lumps bobbed limply at the edge of the surf, and Geryon resolutely kept his eyes away from those mute remains of the Murgo sailors who had been washed overboard and drowned when the ship had crashed into the reef. Then, far up the coast, he saw a number of red-sailed ships beating their way along the south shore of the Goran Sea toward the broken remains of the ship lying on the beach below. Belgarath and Eriond pushed their way past the sailcloth door Durnik had hung across the arched entrance to the cellar the night before to join Geryon on the ledge.
"It quit raining, at least," Geryon reported.
"And the wind seems to be dropping."
"There's that problem, though."
He pointed at the Malorian ships coming up the coast. Belgarath grunted.
"They're certain to come ashore when they see the wreck. I think it's time for us to leave here."
Eriond was looking around with a strange expression on his face.
"It hasn't changed much," he noted.
He pointed toward a small grassy bench at the far end of the ledge.
"I used to play there. When Zadar let me come outside, anyway."
"Did he talk to you very much while you were staying here?"
"Oh, not very often,"
Eriond shrugged.
"He kept pretty much to himself. He had some books with him, and he used to spend most of his time with them."
"It must have been a lonely way to grow up," Geryon said.
"Oh, it wasn't so bad. I used to spend a lot of my time watching the clouds and the birds. In the springtime, the birds nest in holes in the face of the bluff. If you lean out over the edge, you can see them coming and going. I always used to like watching the fledglings when they first tried out their wings."
"Do you have any idea of how far it is to the high road that leads inland?"
"It used to take us about a day to get there. Of course, I was small then, and I couldn't walk very fast."
Belgarath nodded. He shaded his eyes with one hand and looked at the Malorian ships laboring up the coast.
"I think we had better go tell the others. We won't accomplish too much by trying to hold this place against several shiploads of the Malorian sailors."
It took perhaps an hour to gather up their still wet clothing and their meager food supply and load the pack horses. They pushed their way out past the sailcloth door and led their horses to the far side of the headland. Geryon noticed that Eriond looked back once with a faintly regretful expression, then resolutely turned his back on his childhood home and faced the grassland lying ahead.
"I sort of know the way. Those creeks out there are running bank full, though, so we'll have to be careful."
He swung lightly up into the saddle.
"I'll go on ahead and pick the best route."
He leaned forward and stroked his stallion's neck. Then he smiled.
"Horse wants to run a bit anyway."
He moved off down the hill at a rolling gallop.
"That is a very strange boy," Urgot said as he mounted. "Did he really know Zadar?"
"Oh, yes," Silk replied.
"And also Tuchik."
He gave Polgara a sly look.
"He's been consorting with strange people all of his life, so his peculiarities aren't really all that hard to understand."
The small patches of blue that had touched the southeastern sky when Geryon had first awakened had spread now, and columns of bright morning sunlight streamed down through the misty air, stalking ponderously across the stream-laced grassland below. The wind had abated to little more than a gusty breeze, and they rode on down through the still-wet grass at a brisk canter. They followed the trail Eriond and his exuberant horse had left.
Tinedra, dressed now in one of Eriond's tunics and a pair of woolen leggings, pulled in beside Geryon.
"I like your outfit, my queen."
"But my dresses were still wet," she said.
She paused, her face growing somber.
It's not working out very well, is it, Garion? We were counting so much on that ship.
Oh, I don't know. We saved a bit of time. We managed to get around most of the war zone. Once we get past Rakthaka, maybe we'll be able to find another ship. I don't think we actually lost any time.
But we didn't gain any either, did we?
It's hard to say exactly.
She sighed, and rode on beside him in silence. They reached the high road about noon and turned eastward, making good time for the rest of the day. There was no sign that any of the travelers had recently used the road, but Silk ranged out in front of them as a precautionary scout. A clump of willows at the side of the road afforded some shelter that night, and provided the poles necessary for erecting their tents. Supper that evening consisted of beans and bacon, a meal which Urgot in particular found less than satisfying.
"I would give anything for a chunk of beef right now. Even one as badly prepared as the cooks at the Drojum used to offer to me."
"Would you prefer a bowl of boiled grass, Your Majesty?"
Prala asked him pertly.
"Or perhaps a nice plate of fried willow bark?"
He gave her a sour look, then turned to Garion.
"Tell me, do you and your friends plan to remain long in Tol Murgos?"
"Not too long. Why?"
"Western ladies seem to have a broad streak of independence in their nature, and a regrettable tendency to speak their minds. I find their influence on certain impressionable Murgo ladies to be unwholesome."
Then, as if suddenly realizing that he might have gone too far, he threw an apprehensive glance in Polgara's direction.
"No offense intended, my lady,"
he apologized quickly.
"Just an old Murgo prejudice."
I see," she replied. Bilgareth set aside his plate and looked over at Silk.
"You were out in front all day. Did you happen to see any game moving about?"
"There were herds of what looked like some sort of large deer moving north," the little man answered. "But they stayed a long way out of bowshot."
"What have you got in mind, old man?" Polgara asked.
"We need fresh meat, Paul," Belgareth said, rising to his feet. "Moldy bacon and boiled beans aren't going to get us very far."
He stepped out of the small circle of light and squinted up at the moon-speckled clouds drifting across the stars.
"It might be a good night for hunting. What do you think?"
A curious smile touched her lips, and she also rose.
"Do you think you can still keep up, old wolf?"
"Well enough, I suppose," he said blandly. "Come along, Garion. Let's get a little way from the horses."
"Where are they going?"
Urgot asked Silk.
"Oh, you don't want to know, my brother. You really don't want to know."
The moon touched the grass, waving in the night breeze with silvery light. The scents of the grassland around them came sharply to Garion's nostrils, as his tenfold heightened sense of smell tasted the odors of the night. He loped easily at the side of the great silvery wolf while the snowy owl ghosted through the moonlight above them. It was good again to run tirelessly with the wind ruffling his fur and his toenails digging into the damp turf as he and his grandfather wolf ranged out across the moon-silvered grass in the ancient rite of the hunt. They started a herd of deer-like creatures from their matted grass beds some leagues east of their camp, and pursued them for miles across the rolling hills. Then, as the terrified animals plunged across a rain-swollen creek, an old buck, pushed to exhaustion, missed his footing, tumbled end over end, throwing up a great spray of water, and came to rest against the far bank, his antlers digging into the shore, and his grotesquely twisted head proclaiming that his fall had snapped his neck. Without thinking, Garion leaped from the bank into the swollen creek, drove himself rapidly across, and caught the dead buck by the foreleg with his powerful jaws. Straining, he dragged the still-warm carcass up onto the bank before the rushing creek could sweep it away.
Belgarath and Polgara, who had once again resumed their natural forms, came sauntering up the gravel bank as calmly as if they were on an evening stroll.
"He's very good, isn't he?"
Polgara observed.
Not bad,
Belgorath admitted. Then he drew his knife from his belt and tested its edge with his thumb.
We will dress this deer out. Why don't you go back and get Dernick and the pack horse?
All right, father,
she agreed, shimmering in the moonlight and swooping away on silent wings.
You're going to need your hands, Geryon, the old man said pointedly.
Oh, Geryon said, in the manner of the wolves, and rose from his haunches. Sorry, grandfather, I forgot. He changed back into his own form a little regretfully. There were some queer looks the following morning when Polgara served up steaks instead of porridge, but no one chose to say anything about the sudden change of diet. They rode on for the next 2 days, with the last rack and tatter of the dying storm flowing overhead. About noon, they crested a long hill and saw before them the broad blue expanse of a great body of water.
Lake Tacha, Urgot said. Once we circle that, we're only 2 days from Rakh Tacha itself.
Sorry, Belgorath said.
Have you got your map?
Right here, Ancient One, the eunuch replied, reaching inside his robe.
Let's have a look at it.
The old sorcerer swung down from his horse, took the parchment map from Tzadi, and opened it. The wind coming off of the lake rattled and fluttered the paper, threatening to tear it from his grasp.
Oh, stop that,
he snapped irritably. Then he stared at the map for several long moments.
I think we're going to have to get off of this road. The storm and the wreck have delayed us. We cannot be absolutely certain how far the Malorians have marched since we left Rakurga. I don't want an army catching us with the lake at our backs. The Malorians don't have any reason to be on the south side of the lake, so we will go that way instead.
He pointed at a large area on the map, covered with a representation of trees.
We will find out what the situation is in Rakh Tacha, and if we need to, we will be able to get into the great southern forest.
Belgorath, Dernick said urgently, pointing toward the north. What's that?
A low smudge of black smoke was streaming low to the horizon in the stiff breeze.
Grass fire, perhaps?
Sadi suggested.
Belgorath began to swear. No, it's not the right color.
He pulled the map open again.
There are some villages up there. I think it must be one of them.
Malorians, Urgot gasped.
How could they have gotten this far west?
Silk asked.
Wait a minute,
Geryon said, as a sudden thought came to him. He looked at Urgot.
Who wins when you fight the Malorians in the mountains?
We do, of course. We know how to use the mountains to our advantage.
But when you fight them on the plains, who wins?
They do. They've got more people.
Then your armies are safe only as long as they stay in the mountains.
I already said that, Belgorath.
If I were the one who was fighting you then, I would try to figure out a way to lure you down onto the plains. If I moved around, making threatening noises at Rakh Tacha, you would almost have to respond, wouldn't you? You would send all of your troops out of Urga and Morth to defend the city. But if instead of attacking the city I moved my forces north and west, I could intercept and ambush you out in the open on flat ground. I could pick my battlefields and destroy both your armies in a single day.
Urgot's face had grown very pale.
That's what those Malorian ships were doing in the Gorant Sea, he exclaimed. They were there to spy out the movements of my troops coming from Rakh Urga. Zakath is setting traps for me,
he spun, his eyes wild.
Belgorath, you must let me go and warn my troops. They are completely unprepared for an attack. The Malorians will wipe my army out, and they are the only force between here and Rakh Urga.
Belgorath tugged at one earlobe, squinting at him.
Please, Belgorath.
Do you think you can move fast enough to get ahead of the Malorians?
I have to. If I don't,
Xol Murgos will fall. Blast it, old man. I do have responsibility.
I think that you are finally beginning to learn, Agat. We might make a king out of you after all. Durnik, give him whatever food we can spare.
He turned back to Silk's anxious brother.
Do not take any chances. Stay off of the hilltops where you would be outlined against the sky. Make the best time that you can. But don't kill your horse in the process.
He stopped then, gruffly grasping the weasley-faced man by the shoulders.
Good luck, he said shortly.
Urgot nodded, then turned toward his horse. Prala was right behind him.
What do you think you're doing?
I'm going with you.
You most certainly are not.
We are wasting time.
There's probably going to be a battle, girl. Use your head.
I am a Murgo too. I am descended from the Than dynasty. I am not afraid of battles.
She caught the reins of her horse and lifted the long black leather case down from her saddle. She untied the fastenings and snapped the case open. Inside lay a sword, its hilt encrusted with rubies. She lifted it from the case and held it aloft.
This is the sword of the last king of the Than dynasty. He took the field with it at Vomimbre. Do not dishonor it.
She reversed the blade and offered him the hilt across her forearm. He stared first at her, then at the sword.
It was to have been my gift to you on our wedding day, but you need it now. Take the sword, King of the Murgos, and get on your horse. We have a battle to win.
He took the sword and held it up. The rubies caught the sun like drops of blood on the hilt. Then he suddenly turned as if on impulse.
Cross swords with me, Belgarion, for luck.
Garion nodded and drew his great sword. The fire that ran up its blade was bright blue. When he touched Urgot's extended weapon with it, the smaller man winced as if the hilt of his sword had suddenly burned his hand. Then he stared at it incredulously. The stones on the hilt of his sword were no longer rubies, but bright blue sapphires.
Did you do that?
No. The orb did. It seems to like you for some reason. Good luck, Your Majesty.
Thanks, Your Majesty. And good luck to you, too. All of you.
He started toward his horse again, then turned back and wordlessly caught Silk in a rough embrace.
All right, girl, he said to Prala. Let's go.
Goodbye, Ginevra,
Prala called as she mounted her horse.
Thank you for everything.
The two of them wheeled their horses and raced off toward the north. Silk sighed.
I'm afraid I'm going to lose him.
To the Malorians, you mean?
No, to that girl.
She had a marrying sort of expression on her face when they left.
I think it is sweet,
Tenedra sniffed.
Sweet? I think it's revolting.
He looked around. If we're going around the south end of the lake, we had better get started. They galloped south along the lake shore through the long, golden, slanting beams of the afternoon sunlight until they were a couple of leagues from the place where Urgot and Prala had so abruptly left them. Then Silk, ranging once again ahead of them, crested a hill and motioned to them to come ahead, but cautiously.
What is it? Belgaroth asked when they joined him.
There's something else burning up ahead. I didn't get too close, but it looks like an isolated farmstead.
Well, let's go look, Durnik said to Toth,
and the two of them rode off in the direction of the smudge of smoke lying low on the horizon to the east.
I'd certainly like to know if Urgot's doing all right, Silk said with a worried frown.
You really like him, don't you?
Velvet asked.
Agat? Yes, I think I do. We are very much alike in many ways. I suppose that you are going to mention all of this in your report to Javelin?
Naturally.
Oh, I really wish you wouldn't, you know.
Why on earth not?
I'm not entirely sure. It's just that for some reason, I don't think I want Thrasnian intelligence using my relationship to the king of Tol Muragos for its own advantage. I think I want to keep it private.
A silver twilight was settling over the lake when Durnek and Toth returned with grim faces.
"It was a Murgo farmstead," Durnek reported. "Some Malorians had been there. I don't think they were regular troops. Probably deserters of some kind. They looted and they burned. Regular troops don't usually do that, if they've got officers around to control them. Well, the house is gone, but the barn is still partially intact."
"Is there enough of it left to shelter us for the night?"
Durnek looked dubious, then shrugged.
"The roof's still mostly there." "Is something wrong?"
Belgarath asked him. Durnek made a small gesture and then walked away until he was out of earshot of the rest. Geryon and Belgarath followed him.
"What's the matter, Durnek?" "Well, a barn's good enough to give us shelter, all right. But I think I ought to let you know that those Malorian deserters impaled everybody on the farmstead. I don't think you want the ladies to see that. It's not very pleasant."
"Is there some place where you can get the bodies under cover?"
"Well, I'll see what I can do. Why do people do that sort of thing?"
"Ignorance, usually. An ignorant man falls back on brutality, out of a lack of imagination. Go with them, Geryon. They might need some help. Wave a torch to let us know when you have gotten it finished."
The fact that it was nearly dark helped a little. Geryon was unable to see the faces of the people on the stakes. There was a sod-roofed cellar at the back of the still smoldering house, and they put the bodies there. Then Geryon took up a torch and walked some distance from the house to signal to Belgarath. The barn was dry, and the fire that Durnek built in a carefully cleared area on the stone floor soon warmed it.
"This is actually pleasant,"
Tynedra declared, with a smile as she looked around at the dancing shadows on the walls and rafters. She sat on a pile of fragrant hay and bounced tentatively a few times.
"And this will make wonderful beds. I hope we can find a place like this every night."
Geryon walked over to the door and looked out, not trusting himself to answer her. He had grown up on a farm, and not really one that was much different from this. The thought of a band of marauding soldiers swooping down on Faldor's farm, burning and killing, filled him with a vast outrage. A sudden image arose in his mind. The shadowy faces of the dead Murgos hanging on those stakes might very well have been the faces of his childhood friends, and that thought shook him to the very core of his being. The dead here had been Murgos, but they had also been farmers, and he felt a sudden kinship with them. The savagery that had befallen them began to take on the aspect of a personal affront, and dark thoughts began to fill his mind. Chapter 21. By morning it was raining again, a drizzly sort of rain that made the surrounding countryside hazy and indistinct. They rode out from the ruins of the farmstead, dressed again in their slaver's robes, and turned northward along the eastern shore of the lake. Geryon rode in silence, his thoughts as somber as the leaden waters of the lake lying to the left. The rage he had felt the previous evening had settled into an icy resolve. Justice, he had been told, was an abstraction, but he was determined that, should the Malorian deserters responsible for the atrocity at the farm ever cross his path, he would turn the abstract into an immediate reality. He knew that Belgarath and Polgara did not approve of that sort of thing, so he kept his peace and contemplated the idea of vengeance, if not justice. When they reached the muddy road coming in off of the northern end of the lake and stretching out toward the southeast and the city of Rakthacha, they found it clogged with a horde of terrified civilians, dressed for the most part in ragged clothing and carrying bundles of what few possessions they had been able to salvage.
"I think we'll stay off of this road," Belgarath decided. "We could never make any time through that mob.
"Are we going on to Rakhtacha?"
Tsadi asked him. Bolgarath looked at the crowd streaming along the road.
"I don't think you could find a raft in Rakhtacha right now, much less a ship. Let's go on into the forest and work our way south through the trees. I don't much like staying out in this open, hostile territory, and the fishing villages are better places to hire boats than the piers of a major city."
"Why don't you and the others ride on?" Silk suggested. "I would like to ask them a few questions."
Belgarath grunted. "That might not be a bad idea. Just don't be too long at it. I would like to reach the Great Southern Forest sometime before the end of winter, if I can possibly manage it."
"I'll go with him, Grandfather. I need to get my mind off of some things I've seen lately, anyway." The two of them rode through the knee-high grass toward the broad stream of frightened refugees fleeing southward.
"Geryon," Silk said, reining in his horse, "isn't that a Sindar? The one pushing the wheelbarrow?"
Geryon shielded his eyes from the rain and peered at the sturdy fellow that Silk had pointed out. "He sort of looks like a Sindar. But what would a Sindar be doing down here in Tol Murugos?"
"Why don't we go ask him? Sindars love to gossip, so he can probably give us some idea of what's been happening."
The little man walked his horse over until he was riding beside the stout man with the wheelbarrow.
"Good morning, friend," he said pleasantly. "You're a long way from home, aren't you?"
The stout man set down his barrow and eyed Silk's green Naysan robe apprehensively.
"Well, I'm not a slave," he declared. "So don't be getting any ideas."
"Oh, this," Silk laughed, plucking at the front of the robe.
"Don't worry, friend. We're not Naysans.
We just found these on some bodies back there a ways. We thought they might be a help if we happened to run into somebody official. What in the world are you doing in Tol Murugos?"
"Running," the Sindar said ruefully. "Just like the rest of this rabble. Didn't you hear about what's been happening?"
"No, we've been out of touch."
The stout man lifted the handles of his barrow again and trudged along the grassy shoulder of the road.
"There's a whole Malorian army marching west out of Gorat. They've burned the town I lived in and killed half the people. They didn't even bother with Rakhtacha, so that's where we're all going. I'm going to see if I can find a sea captain who's going in the general direction of Sindaria. For some reason, I'm suddenly homesick."
"You've been living in a Murgo town?"
The fellow made a face.
"It wasn't altogether by choice. I had some trouble with the law in Tol Nedra when I was there on business 10 years ago. I took passage on board a merchantman to get out of the country. That captain was a scoundrel. When my money ran out, he sailed off and left me on the wharf at Rakhtacha. I drifted on up to a town on the north side of the lake. They let me stay because I was willing to do things that are beneath Murgo's dignity. But they were too important to trust a slave to do. Sort of degrading, but it was a living. Anyway, a couple of days ago, the Malorians marched through. When they left, there wasn't a single building standing."
"And how did you escape?"
"I hid under a haystack till dark. That's when I joined this mob."
He glanced over at the crowd of refugees slogging through the ankle-deep mud in the road.
"Isn't that pathetic? They don't even have enough sense to spread out and walk on the grass. You certainly wouldn't see soldiers doing that, let me tell you."
"Oh, you've had some military experience, then?"
"I most certainly have," the stout man replied proudly. "I was a sergeant in Princess Tenedra's army. I was at Tol Mardu with her."
"Oh, I missed that one," Silk told him with aplomb. "I was busy someplace else. Are there any Malorians between here and the Great Southern Forest?"
"Eh, who knows? I don't go looking for Malorians." "Ah, but you don't really want to go into the forest, though. All of this killing has stirred up them Raveners."
"Raveners? And what's that?"
"Ghouls. They feed on dead bodies most of the time. Ah, but I've heard some ugly stories lately. Very ugly. I'd make a special point of staying out of that forest, my friend.
We might have to keep that in mind. Thanks for the information. Good luck when you get to Rakthaka. And I hope you make it back to Kamar.
Right now, I'd settle for Tol Honoth. Tol Nedrin jails aren't really all that bad.
Silk grinned at him quickly, turned his horse and led Geryon away from the road at a gallop to rejoin the others. That afternoon, they forded the river Thaka, some leagues upstream from the coast. The drizzle slackened as evening approached, though the sky remained cloudy. Once they had reached the far side of the river, they could see the irregular dark shape of the edge of the great southern forest, looming up beyond perhaps a league of open grassland.
Shall we try for it?
Let's wait, Belgarath decided. I'm just a little concerned about what that fellow you talked with said. I'm not sure I want any surprises, particularly in the dark. Well, there's a willow thicket downstream a ways,
Durnick said, pointing at a fair-sized grove of spindly trees that bordered the river a half-mile or so to the south.
Taller than I can pitch the tents there. All right, then,
Belgarath agreed. How far is it to Verkat now, Grandfather?
Geryon asked, as they rode down along the rain-swollen river toward the willows. According to the map, it is about 50 leagues to the southeast, before we reach the coast opposite of the island. Then we'll have to find a boat to get us across. Geryon sighed. Now don't get discouraged, Belgarath told him. We are making better time than I had originally expected, and Xandramos cannot run forever. There is only so much land in this world. Sooner or later we will chase her down.
As Durnick and Toth pitched the tents, Geryon and Ariond ranged out through the sodden willow thicket in search of firewood. It was difficult to find anything sufficiently dry to burn, and the effort of an hour yielded only enough twigs and small branches from under fallen trees to make a meager cook fire for Polgara. As she began to prepare their evening meal of beans and venison, Geryon noted that Sadi was walking about their campsite, combing the ground with his eyes.
"This isn't funny, dear," he said quite firmly. "Now you come out this very minute."
"What's the matter?" Durnick asked him.
"Zith." "She's not in her bottle," Sadi replied, still searching.
Durnick rose from where he was sitting quite rapidly.
"Are you sure?"
"She thinks it's amusing to hide from me sometimes. Now you come out immediately, you naughty snake."
"You probably should not tell Silk," Belgarath advised. "He will go directly into hysterics if he finds out that she is loose."
The old man looked around.
"Where is he, by the way?"
"He and Lassell went for a walk,"
Ariond told him.
"In all of this wet? You know, sometimes I wonder about him."
Tenedra came over and sat on the log beside Geryon. He put his arm about her shoulders and drew her close to him. She snuggled down and sighed.
"I wonder what Geryon is doing tonight,"
she said wistfully. "Sleeping, probably."
"He always looked so adorable when he was asleep,"
she sighed again, then closed her eyes. There was a crashing back in the willows, and Silk suddenly ran into the circle of firelight, his eyes very wide and his face deathly pale.
"Oh, what's the matter?" Durnick exclaimed.
"She had that snake in her bodice," Silk blurted.
"Oh, who did?"
"Lissel."
Polgara, holding a ladle in one hand, turned to regard the violently trembling little man with one raised eyebrow.
"Tell me, Prince Keldar,"
she said in a cool voice,
"exactly what were you doing in the Margravine Lassell's bodice?"
Silk endured that steady gaze for a moment. Then he actually began to blush furiously.
"Oh, I see," she said.
She turned back to her cooking. It was past midnight, and Geryon was not sure what it was that had awakened him. He moved slowly to avoid waking Tenedra, and carefully parted the tent flap to look out. A dense, clinging fog had arisen from the river. All that he could see was a curtain of solid, dirty white. He lay quietly, straining his ears to catch any sound. From somewhere off in the fog, he heard a faint clinking sound. It took him a moment to identify it. Finally, he realized that what he was hearing was the sound of a mounted man wearing a mail shirt. He reached over in the darkness and took up his sword.
"I still think you ought to tell us what you found in that house before you set it on fire,"
he heard someone say in a gruff, Malorian-accented voice. The speaker was not close, but sounds at night traveled far, so Garion could clearly understand what was being said.
"It wasn't much, Corporal,"
another Malorian voice replied evasively.
"A bit of this, a bit of that."
"I think you are to share those things with the rest of us. We are all in this together, after all."
"Isn't it odd that you didn't think of that until after I managed to pick up a few things? If you want to share in the loot, then you should pay attention to the houses and not spend all of your time impaling the prisoners."
"We're at war,"
a corporal declared piously.
"It's our duty to kill the enemy."
"Duty?"
the second Malorian snorted derisively.
"We are deserters, Corporal. Our only duty is to ourselves. If you want to spend your time butchering Murgo farmers, that's up to you. But I am saving up for my retirement."
Garion carefully rolled out from under the tent flap. He felt a peculiar calm, almost as if his emotions had somehow been set aside. He rose and moved silently to where the packs were piled and burrowed his hand into them, one by one, until his fingers touched steel. Then, carefully, so that it made no sound, he drew out his heavy mail shirt. He pulled it on and shrugged his shoulders a couple of times to settle it into place. Toth was standing guard near the horses, his huge bulk looming in the fog.
"There's something I have to take care of,"
Garion whispered softly to the mute giant. Toth looked at him gravely, then nodded. He turned, untied a horse from the picket line, and handed him the reins. Then he put one huge hand on Garion's shoulder, squeezed once in silent approval, and stepped back. Garion did not want to give the Malorian deserters time to lose themselves in the fog, so he pulled himself up onto the unsaddled horse and moved out of the willow thicket at a silent walk. The fading voices that had come out of the fog had seemed to be moving in the direction of the forest, and Garion rode quietly after them, probing the foggy darkness ahead with his ears and with his mind. After he had ridden for perhaps a mile, he heard a raucous laugh coming from somewhere ahead and slightly to the left.
"Did you hear the way they squealed when we impaled them?"
a coarse voice came out of the clinging mist.
"That does it,"
Garion grated between clenched teeth as he drew his sword. He directed his horse toward the sound, then nudged his heels at the animal's flanks. The horse moved faster, his hooves making no sound on the damp earth.
"Let's have some light,"
one of the deserters said.
"Do you think it's safe? There are patrols out looking for deserters."
"It's after midnight. The patrols are all in bed. Go ahead, light the torch."
After a moment, there was a fatally ruddy beacon glowing in the dark, reaching out to Garion. His charge caught the deserters totally by surprise. Several of them were dead before they even knew that he was upon them. There were screams and shouts from both sides as he crashed through them, chopping them out of their saddles with huge strokes to the right and to the left. His great blade sheared effortlessly through the mail, bone, and flesh. He sent five of them tumbling to the ground as he thundered through their ranks. Then he whirled on the three who still remained. After one startled look, one of them fled, another dragged his sword from its sheath, and the third, who held the torch, sat frozen in astonished terror. The Malorian with the sword feebly raised his weapon to protect his head from the dreadful blow Garion had already launched. The great overhand sweep, however, shattered the doomed man's sword blade and sheared down through his helmet halfway to his waist. Roughly, Geryon kicked the twitching body off of his sword and turned on the torchbearer.
"Please!" the terrified man cried, trying to back his horse away. "Have mercy!"
For some reason, that plaintive cry infuriated Geryon all the more. He clenched his teeth together. With a single broad swipe, he sent the murderer's head spinning off into the foggy darkness. He pulled his horse up sharply, cocked his head for a moment to pick up the sound of the last Malorian's galloping flight, and set out in pursuit. It took him only a few minutes to catch up with the fleeing deserter. At first he had only the sound to follow, but then he was able to make out the dim, shadowy form racing ahead of him in the fog. He veered slightly to the right, plunged on past the desperate man, then pulled his horse directly into the shadowy deserter's path.
"Who are you?"
The unshaven Malorian squealed as he hauled his mount to a sudden and rearing stop.
"Why are you doing this?"
"I am Justice," Geryon grated at him, and quite deliberately ran the man through. The deserter stared in horrified amazement at the huge sword protruding from his chest. With a gurgling sigh, he toppled to one side, sliding limply off of the blade. Still without any real sense of emotion, Geryon dismounted and wiped the blade of his sword on the dead man's tunic. Almost as an afterthought, he caught the reins of the fellow's horse, remounted, and turned back toward the place where he had killed the others. Carefully, one by one, he checked each fallen body for signs of life, then rounded up three more horses and rode back to the camp concealed in the willows. Silk stood beside the huge Toth near the picket line. "Where have you been?" he demanded in a hoarse whisper as Geryon dismounted. "We needed some more horses," Geryon replied, handing the reins of the captured mounts to Toth. "Malorian ones, judging from the saddles," Silk noted. "How did you find them?" "Their riders were talking as they went by. They seemed to be quite amused by a visit they had paid to a Murgo farmstead a few days ago." "And you didn't even invite me to go along," Silk accused. "Sorry, but I had to hurry. I didn't want to lose them in the fog."
"Four of them?" Silk asked, counting horses.
"I couldn't find the other four mounts," Geryon shrugged. "These ought to be enough to make up for the ones we lost during the shipwreck, though."
"Eight?" Silk looked a bit startled at that.
"I came on them by surprise. It wasn't much of a fight. Why don't we get some sleep?"
Geryon, it might not be a bad idea for you to wash up before you go back to bed. Zenedra's nerves are a little delicate. She might be upset if she woke up and saw you covered with blood in the way you are."
The fog was even thicker the following morning. It was a heavy fog, chill and clinging, lying densely along the riverbank and bedewing the tangled limbs of the willow thicket at their backs with strings of pearl-like droplets.
"Well, it hides us at least," Geryon observed, still feeling that peculiar remoteness.
"It also hides anybody else who might be out there," Sadi told him. "Or any thing. That forest up ahead has a bad reputation."
"Just how big is it?"
"It's probably the largest forest in the world," Sadi replied, lifting a pack up onto a horse's back. "It goes on for hundreds of leagues."
He looked curiously down the picket line.
"Is it my imagination, or do we have more horses this morning?"
"I happened to cross a few last night."
After breakfast, they packed up Palgro's cooking utensils, mounted, then started out across the intervening grasslands toward the forest lying hidden in the fog. As Geryon rode, he heard Silk and Durnik talking right behind him.
"Just what were you doing last night?" Durnik asked directly. "When you found Zith in the Zell's bodice, I mean?"
"She's going to make a report to Javelin when this is all over. There are some things I would rather he didn't know. If I can get on friendly terms with her, maybe I can persuade her to
overlook those things in her report.
Oh, it's really rather contemptible, you know. She's just a girl.
Oh, believe me, Dernick. Lascelles can take care of herself. The two of us are playing a game. I'll admit that I hadn't counted on Zith, though.
Oh, do Drasnians always have to play games?
Of course. It helps to pass the time. Winters are very long and tedious in Drasnia. The games we play sharpen our wits and make us better at what we do when we aren't playing.
The little man raised his voice slightly.
Garion?
Yes?
Are we avoiding the place where you, found those horses last night? We would not want to upset the lady so soon after breakfast.
It's over that way.
Garion gestured off to the left.
What's this?
The extra animals came from a group of Malorian deserters who used to creep up on isolated Murgo farmlands. Garion saw to it that they won't be needing the horses any more.
How? Dernick said.
He thought about it for a moment.
Good,
he said finally. The dark trees loomed out of the fog as the company approached the edge of the forest. The leaves had turned brown and clung sparsely to the branches, for winter was not too far off. As they rode in under the twisted branches, Garion looked around, trying to identify the trees. But they were of kinds that he did not recognize. They were gnarled into fantastic shapes, and their limbs seemed almost to writhe up and out from their massy trunks, reaching toward the sunless sky. Their gnarled stems were dotted with dark knots, deeply indented in the coarse bark, and the knots seemed somehow to give each tree a grotesque semblance of a distorted human face, with wide, staring eyes and a gaping mouth, twisted into an expression of unspeakable horror. The forest floor was deep with fallen leaves, blackened and sodden, and the fog hung gray beneath the branches spreading above. Tenedra drew her cloak more tightly about her and shuddered.
Do we have to go through this forest?
I thought you liked the trees.
Not these.
She looked about fearfully.
There is something very cruel about them. They hate each other.
Hate? Trees?
They struggle and push each other, trying to reach the sunlight. I don't like this place, Garion.
Try not to think about it.
They pushed deeper and deeper into the gloomy woods, riding in silence for the most part. Their spirits sunk low by the pervasive gloom and by the cold antagonism seeping from the strange, twisted trees. They took a brief, cold lunch, then rode on toward a somber twilight which seemed hardly more than a deepening of the foggy half-dark spreading beneath the hateful trees.
"I guess that we have gone far enough," Belgarath said finally. "Let's get a fire going and put up those tents."
It might have been only Garion's imagination, or perhaps the cry of some hunting bird of prey, but as the first few flickering tongues of flame curled up around the sticks in the fire pit, it seemed that he heard a shriek coming from the trees themselves, a shriek of fear mingled with a dreadful rage. And as he looked around, the distorted semblances of human faces deeply indented in the surrounding tree trunks seemed to move in the flickering light, silently howling at the hated fire. After they had eaten, Garion walked away from the fire. He still felt strangely numb inside, as if his emotions had been enclosed in some kind of protective blanket. He found he could no longer even remember the details of last night's encounter, but only brief, vivid flashes of blood spurting in ruddy torchlight, of riders tumbling limply out of their saddles, and of the torchbearer's head flying off into the dark fog.
"Do you want to talk about it?"
Belgarath asked quietly from just behind him.
"Not really, Grandfather. I don't think you would approve of what I did. So why don't we just let it go at that? There's no way that I could make you understand."
"Oh, I understand, Garion. I just don't think that you accomplished anything, that's all. You killed, how many was it?"
"8."
"That many? All right, 8 Malorians. What did you prove by it?"
I wasn't really out to prove anything, Grandfather. I just wanted to make sure that they never did it again. I can't even be absolutely certain that they were the men who killed those Murgle farmers. They did kill some people some place, though, and people who do that sort of thing need to be stopped.
Well, you did that all right. Does it make you feel any better?
No, I suppose not. I wasn't even angry when I killed them. It was just something that had to be done, so I did it. Now it's over, and I'd just as soon forget about it.
Belgarath gave him a long, steady look. All right. As long as you keep that family in mind, I guess you haven't done yourself any permanent injury. Come, let's go back to the fire. It is chilly out here in these woods.
Geryon slept badly that night, and Senedra huddled almost fearfully in his arms, stirring restlessly and often whimpering in her sleep. The next morning, Belgarath rose and looked about with a dark scowl.
"Oh, this is absurd," he burst out quite suddenly. "Where is the sun?"
"Behind the clouds and fog, Father," Belgarath replied, as she calmly brushed her long dark hair.
"I know that, Paul, but I need to see it, even if only briefly, to get our direction. We could wind up wandering around in circles."
Toth, who had been building up the fire, looked over at the old man, his face impassive as always. He raised one hand and pointed in a direction somewhat at an oblique from that which they had been following the previous evening. Belgarath frowned.
"Are you absolutely sure?"
Toth nodded.
"Have you been through these woods before?"
Again, the mute nodded, then firmly pointed once more in the same direction.
"And if we go that way, we are going to come out on the south coast in the vicinity of the Isle of Verkat?"
Toth nodded again, and went back to tending the fire. "Saradus said that he was coming along to aid us in the search, Grandfather," Geryon reminded him.
"All right. Since he knows the way, we will let him lead us through this forest. I am tired of guessing."
They had gone perhaps 2 leagues that cloudy morning, with Toth confidently leading them along a scarcely perceptible track, when Polgara quite suddenly reined in her horse with a warning cry. "Look out!" An arrow sizzled through the foggy air directly at Toth, but the huge man swept it aside with his staff. Then a gang of rough-looking men, some Murgos, some of indeterminate race, came rushing out of the woods, brandishing a variety of weapons. Without a moment's hesitation, Silk rolled out of his saddle, his hands diving under his slaver's robe for his daggers. As the bawling ruffians charged forward, he leaped to meet them, his heavy daggers extended in front of him like a pair of spears. Even as Geryon jumped to the ground, he saw Toth already advancing, his huge staff whirling as he bore down on the attackers, and Durnik, holding his axe in both hands, circling to the other side. Geryon swept Iron Grip's sword from its scabbard and ran forward, swinging the flaming blade in great arcs. One of the ruffians launched himself into the air, twisting as he did so in a clumsy imitation of a maneuver Geryon had seen Silk perform so many times in the past. This time, however, the technique failed. Instead of driving his heels into Geryon's face or chest, the agile fellow encountered the point of the burning sword, and his momentum quite smoothly skewered him on the blade. Silk ripped open an attacker with one of his daggers, spun, and drove his other knife directly into the forehead of another. Toth and Durnik, moving in from opposite sides, drove several of the assailants into a tight knot and methodically began to brain them one after another as they struggled to disentangle themselves from each other.
"Geryon!"
Tenedra cried, and he whirled to see a burly, unshaven man pulling the struggling little queen from her saddle with one hand, even as he raised the knife he held in the other. Then he dropped the knife, and both of his hands flew up to grasp the slim, silken cord that had suddenly been looped about his neck from the rear. Calmly, the golden-haired velvet, her knee pushed firmly against the wildly threshing man's back, pulled her cord tighter and tighter. Tsinedra watched in horror as her would-be killer was efficiently strangled before her eyes. Geryon grimly turned and began to chop his way through the now disconcerted attackers. The air around him was suddenly filled with shrieks and groans and chunks of clothing and flesh. The ragged-looking men he faced flinched back as his huge sword laid a broad windrow of quivering dead in his wake. Then they broke and ran.
"Cowards!"
a black-robed man screamed after the fleeing villains. He held a bow in his hand, and he raised it, pointing his arrow directly at Geryon. Then he suddenly doubled over sharply, driving his arrow into the ground before him as one of Silk's daggers, flickering end over end, sunk solidly into his stomach. "Is anybody hurt?" Geryon demanded, spinning around quickly, his dripping sword still in his hand.
"They are," Silk laughed gaily, looking around with some satisfaction at the carnage in the forest clearing.
"Please stop!"
Zinedra cried to Velvet in an anguished voice.
"What?"
the blonde girl asked absently, still kneeling back against the silken cord drawn tightly about the neck of the now limp man she had just strangled.
"Oh, I am sorry, Zinedra," she apologized. "My attention wandered a bit, I guess."
She released the cord, and the black-faced dead man toppled to the ground at her feet.
"Oh, nice job," Silk congratulated her.
"Very routine,"
she shrugged, carefully coiling up her garrote.
"You seem to be taking it quite calmly."
"There's no particular reason to get excited, Keldar. It is part of what we are trained to do, after all."
He looked as if he were about to reply, but her matter-of-fact tone obviously baffled him.
"Yes?"
she asked.
"Nothing."
Chapter 22
"Stop that!" Durnik said in disgust to Tsadi, who was moving about the clearing casually sticking his small poisoned dagger into each of the bodies littering the ground.
"Just making sure, good man," Tsadi replied coolly. "It is not prudent to leave an enemy behind you who might be feigning death."
He moved over to the black-robed man, whom Silk had felled.
"What's this?"
he said with some surprise.
"This one's still alive."
He reached down to push the dying man's hood aside and look at his face, then pulled back his hand with a sharp intake of breath.
"You had better have a look at this one, Belgarath."
Belgarath crossed the clearing to the eunuch's side.
"Doesn't that purple lining on the inside of his hood mean that he's a Grolem?"
Belgarath nodded bleakly. He bent and lightly touched the hilt of Silk's dagger that still protruded from the robed man's stomach.
"He doesn't have much time left. Can you get him conscious enough to answer a few questions?"
"I can try."
Tsadi went to his horse and took a vial of yellow liquid from his red case.
"Could you get me a cup of water, goodman?"
he asked Durnik. The smith's face was disapproving, but he fetched a tin cup from one of the packs and filled it from one of their water bags. Tsadi carefully measured a few drops of the yellow liquid into the cup, swirled it around a few times. He knelt beside the dying man and almost tenderly lifted his head.
"Here,"
he said gently,
"drink this. It might make you feel better."
He supported the Grolem's head on his arm and held the cup to his lips. Weakly, the stricken man drank, then lay back. After a moment, a serene smile came to his ashen face.
"There. Isn't that better?"
"Much better," the dying man croaked.
"That was quite a skirmish, wasn't it?"
"We thought to surprise you,"
the Grolem admitted.
"But we were the ones who got the surprise."
"Your master, what was his name again? I'm terrible with names."
"Morgat,"
the Grolem supplied with a bemused look on his face.
"Hierarch of Rakhtan."
"Oh, yes, now I remember. Anyway, Morgat should have given you more men to help you."
"I hired those men myself at Rakhtaka
They told me they were professionals, but...
And he began to cough weakly.
Don't tire yourself, Sadi said.
He paused.
What is Morcott's interest in us?
He's acting on the instructions of Agajak,
the Grolem replied, his voice now little more than a whisper.
Agajak, he's not one to take chances. Some very serious accusations were made at Rak Urka, I understand. Agajak has ordered that every Grolem priest of the Purple should seek you out.
Sadi sighed.
It's more or less what I had expected, he said mournfully. People always seem to distrust me. Tell me, how did you ever manage to find us?
It was Tragyaska,
the Grolem replied, his breathing growing even more labored.
It's a cursed song. Rings across Dolmurgos like a beacon. Join every Grolem of the Purple directly to you.
The dying man drew in a deep breath, and his unfocused eyes suddenly became alert.
What was in that cup?
He demanded sharply. He pushed Thoughty's arm away and tried to rise to a sitting position. A great gush of blood spurted from his mouth. His eyes went blank. He shuddered once, with a long, gurgling groan. Then he fell limply back.
Dead, Sadi noted clinically. That's the problem with Oret. It's a little hard on the heart, and this fellow wasn't in very good shape to begin with. I'm sorry, Belgarath, but it was the best that I could do.
It was enough, Sadi, the old man replied bleakly. Come with me, Geryon. Let's go someplace quiet. You and I are going to have a long talk with the orb.
Do you suppose you could hold off on that, Belgarath?
Sadi asked, looking around nervously.
I think we want to get as far away from here as we can, almost immediately.
I hardly expect these fellows to come back, Sadi, Silk drawled.
That is not what concerns me, Keldar. It's not prudent to remain in the vicinity of so many dead bodies in this forest, and we have lingered much too long already.